All right, well then, let's get this started in the traditional manner.
Yeah, we're ready to rock. All right, I guess this week on Physics Frontiers, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite theoretical physics rock stars, a CERN theoretical physicist named Dragon. I'm sorry, Dragon. It looks like it's spelled Dragon, but it's Dragan Hajduković. He's a physicist from Montenegro, and he has an amazing idea that defies a lot of our common sense notions of matter and gravity, but explains a huge range of current cosmological conundrums. His idea, to be, I guess, let me see if I can say this differently. Dr. Hajdukovic's idea appears to explain dark matter, dark energy, the unresolved cosmic inflation mechanism of the Big Bang, using a single postulate that antimatter falls up in a gravitational field. So in any case, the idea is that if matter has a positive gravitational charge and antimatter has a negative gravitational charge, then the quantum vacuum fluctuations that we know and love, which we're used to because I believe quantum electrodynamics depends on this idea, is that there's a sea of virtual particles in every cubic centimeter of space. You've got virtual photon pairs appearing and then disappearing, positron-electron pairs appearing and self-annihilating, and even heavier particles, if I understand properly, like protons and antiproton pairs appearing and annihilating simultaneously. And Hajdukovic is saying that another aspect of the quantum vacuum fluctuations is a pair of gravitational charges, gravitational dipoles that are constantly bubbling up into existence and then annihilating each other.
Now, the whole point of this is the idea that antimatter may have a negative gravitational charge. It would still have a positive inertial mass, but the gravitational charge would have the opposite sign. Or at least that's the idea. And then you already have this idea about the quantum vacuum fluctuations, right, from QED, I think, and others in the standard model. In the standard model, you have these vacuum fluctuations, which are basically short-lived pairs of particles, matter plus antimatter, that last for 10 to the minus 22 seconds or something like that. You know, they already have an electric dipole, right? If you have a positron and an electron, you have a positive and a negative electric charge already. And then according to this, you do the same thing with the mass. This makes some sense, at least if you're thinking about some sort of conservation of mass, for example. I don't think that's a really good argument for it. I think that's just a reason why you might think it would occur. So the idea is that you'd simultaneously have dipoles, these gravitational dipoles. You create these two things. They're pretty close to each other for a short time. Pretty close means they're on the order of the Compton wavelength or less. And then they fall back into each other, destroy each other, and have a nice day. And this would be happening all the time, filling up the vacuum with these short-lived virtual pairs. And that's how you'd end up with your gravitational dipoles.
Yes, he's just saying that let's add on to, in addition to the current laundry list of virtual particles popping into and out of existence constantly, let's add gravitational dipoles to the mix and see what happens. And
well, he's not adding anything in. All he's doing is saying the consequence of the hypothesis that antimatter has a negative gravitational charge is that you have these gravitational dipoles, okay? They're associated with those particles. They're nothing new. It's just this is what would happen if antiparticles have a negative mass, which is an open question.
That's right. There's some experiments underway right now at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland and in France that we'll find out soon. They think as early as 2018, the Alpha experiment, and there's also two others, Aegis and GBAR, which are competing to measure the influence of gravity on antimatter. And Alpha is going to do it by creating anti-hydrogen atoms, an antiproton with a positron orbiting it, and then cooling them down so that they're moving slowly enough that they can measure to see if they drop or rise in a gravitational field without any other influences.
Okay, and so soon we're going to find out if there's any basis in fact to this. But this is a big what-if paper.
That's right.
So Hajdukovic is saying that if this is true, what's actually going to happen? What is that going to mean? And he gets some really nice things out of it. Is there anything else at the beginning that you think needs to be said?
Well, I think that we should talk about a little bit about the fact that we know that the quantum vacuum fluctuations are real. Because we've got the QED model, basically, as I understand it, defines the field as the interaction of the virtual particles with charge and so forth. So the field, the magnetic fields that we know, the electrical fields that we know are all manifestations of this interaction with the vacuum. And then there's an even more direct measurement using the Casimir effect, where you can actually place two mirrors, two uncharged mirrors, very close to each other, and there's a pressure differential that pushes those mirrors closer together. And it's exactly the strength that we would expect if the virtual particles were actually physically real. Okay, so I just wanted to go into that a little bit and just describe that the vacuum fluctuations do appear to be a real physical phenomenon. And so if you add in the additional association of the gravitational dipole to this, then we can move forward with his predictions, which are astonishing.
Okay, well, that's pretty good to start with. You want to move on to some of the specific cases? So he has, what was it, five separate cases or six cases? I think one, two, three, four, five cases that he was looking at. Five implications that he was looking at that I think we might want to talk about.
Well, let's first give the name of the paper so that everybody can keep up with us if you want to check it out as we go through this. The name of the paper that we're looking at right now is his 2014 paper called Virtual Gravitational Dipoles, The Key for the Understanding of the Universe. Or with a question mark, I should say. And then I'd also like to mention that there's a 2015 PowerPoint presentation online called What If Quantum Vacuum Fluctuations Are Virtual Gravitational Dipoles? And there's also a little segment where he's interviewed in a BBC production called Project Green Glow, The Quest for Gravity Control, which I checked out this morning. It was kind of fun. So the consequences of his postulate. You wanted to start with the cyclical universe model. That's interesting. Let's start there.
The whole point of this is that we start off, you know, we were just talking about these quantum vacuum fluctuations, right? We're talking about pair production. And that's basically what we think created matter in the universe. We only have one kind of issue with that. That issue is that creation would create equal amounts of matter and antimatter.
That's right. They call this the baryogenesis problem.
And somehow we just have this problem where we don't see a lot of antimatter running around, which is good for us, because if there was a lot of antimatter around, there probably wouldn't be an us running around. But the theory says, and everything looks like it should be, symmetric. But according to Hajdukovic, there should be some sort of issue with that. So how does that work?
Well, in all of the lab experiments and all the phenomena that we see in nature, like the Schwinger mechanism, when particles are created, they're always created in pairs. You've got your particle and your antiparticle. There's only, I think, one case in the standard model where there's some kind of asymmetry in that, and it's an extremely rare phenomenon, I believe, involving the kaon, is that right?
That is correct.
And that mechanism isn't frequent or strong enough to account for the enormous abundance of matter that we see in the universe. And so we're stuck wondering, well, where's the antimatter? And at first there were theories that maybe there are entire galaxies composed of antimatter, because antimatter would react with itself just like matter interacts with itself, and the light and the spectroscopy, we wouldn't know the difference. But it doesn't appear that we see the annihilation events that we'd expect in the universe where matter and antimatter come together, because it creates a very easily identifiable signature of gamma rays. And we don't see these big gamma ray bursts whenever, say, a rogue planet or star goes flying into an antimatter galaxy and annihilates. So Another physicist, an Italian physicist, I believe his name is Vallotta, postulated that, well, maybe antimatter repels other forms of other antimatter and creates these diffuse regions in the voids between galaxies, and maybe those are filled with antimatter. But again, we've got terrific experiment, I believe it's the Alpha 2 experiment, in orbit right now. What's that name? What's the name of that satellite that's detecting particles in orbit around the Earth right now?
No, I have no idea.
I'll have to look that up.
It's not important, yeah.
But we're looking for this. We've been looking for antimatter, and we're not seeing the kind of antimatter that we'd expect. We're not seeing anti-hydrogen. We're not seeing antimatter cosmic rays. At least not in the form that we'd expect if there was a bunch of antimatter out there. And so cosmologists have been stumped by this. How can we explain this abundance of matter in the universe? And Hajdukovic is saying, well, actually, it could be that this universe is dominated by matter and that it's going to go through a cyclical process where eventually the acceleration will slow down, it'll come to a stop, and it'll recollapse. And in the recollapsing of the universe, and it reaches a very dense coalescence where the field, gravitational field is extremely intense, that there's a Schwinger mechanism where all of the matter will be converted into antimatter, and all of the antimatter will be converted into matter. So the next universe will have the opposite abundance of antimatter over matter. So over time, it averages out to a conserved baryon number.
So you're saying he thinks that there's some over time. I mean, what I recalled was he was talking about like a black hole, right? And the black hole sort of starts collapsing in on itself. And eventually gets to the point where if there's antimatter in that region, it just tries to go away from that region. And so all the antimatter gets pushed out from this sort of big crunch event, for example, it gets pushed out from the collapsing black hole. And the same thing would happen with the big crunch. So while the matter was all coalescing, you'd get this spray out of all of this antimatter that was being created through the vacuum fluctuations, because in that actual position, the gravitational field is so strong that it can actually tear these virtual dipoles apart and turn them into real particles.
That's right. Except his theory eliminates the singularity of the Big Bang.
Well, I mean, that is a consequence, and that's one of the nice things about his theory, is that this is a consequence, is that you no longer end up with a Big Bang, really. You don't end up with a big crunch and a Big Bang. What you do is you get everything coming together, and then you have things coming out, and you no longer have the need for something that doesn't quite make sense, like a cosmic inflation model, which is what we're stuck with right now.
That's right. Right now, he's replacing the Big Bang, I guess, with a big bounce, right? Because everything will get down to this extremely dense state, and then the gravitational repulsion will be so strong that it'll bounce outward again. And that it'll keep doing this over and over again, and who knows how long this has been going on. I was wondering if maybe the imbalance between the matter and antimatter, maybe that's a result of that kaon process adding up over successive generations of universes. You know, maybe, I don't know where did the imbalance come from in the first place?
Yeah, that's the major issue with this, is that in the paper, all he says is, well, if the last universe was an antimatter universe, then this universe is a matter universe, and the next universe will be another antimatter universe. But he doesn't say how it starts up or anything like that. So it becomes an explanation, but it becomes one of these explanations that pushes everything back just a little bit farther. But it makes life a little nicer, because you end up getting rid of things like singularities, which apparently this does over and over.
You know, but it's interesting to think about that we do have this one phenomenon in the Standard Model that is not perfectly symmetric. And I wonder if we could predict how many iterations of the universe there would have to have been for there to build up this imbalance of matter and antimatter over time. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, you can think about something like that, but I'm not sure how well. I mean, I think you need to think about that in a lot more detail. And a lot more detail than I understand it.
Yeah, me too. I think that it would be really hard to, but although not necessarily impossible, to calculate what the conditions would really be like in this super dense, big bounce kind of moment with each universal, re-expansion, to try to do a mathematical prediction, on how much pair production would be associated with the kaons and what kind of imbalance you'd get over time. So let's see. He does cover the math pretty thoroughly on here. He doesn't do a lot of extensive derivations, but he's been publishing papers about this idea since about 2011, and there's a series of papers about it. And I think that in different papers he covers different aspects of the idea, and this looks more like a summary of his findings.
Yeah, I mean, he talks a little bit about this stuff. I think the most interesting thing that I saw in there was the whole there being particular shells inside of like that black hole that would be radiating out these different things. So there'd be like an electron positron shell that would be shooting out electrons, for example. And then there'd be a neutron shell that would be shooting out neutrons or whatever. I think it was neutrons. Maybe that was neutrinos. And their radii were different by a factor of 43. So, I mean, it's fairly interesting. I mean, you'd end up getting a spray of electrons right at the beginning, well before you could even get to creating any neutrons at all.
Oh, I wonder how he explained. I didn't see that part where does he talk about how it explains the homogeneity of the universe now? Like, how do they remix if they had such a head start on each other?
Well, these guys wouldn't remix, right?
Well, I mean, the electrons would have to bond to protons later on, right?
Well, they would sometime. Yeah, I mean, and they would if, they're real matter and they're just wandering around doing whatever random things that they're doing, right? The question just becomes, when they're going to do that. It's been a long time since people were trying to make anti-hydrogen in the lab just to prove you could make anti-hydrogen. These things will happen. You've got billions of years to make it happen, right? More than billions of years to make it happen.
But yeah, and you'd have to explain the time frame and the cosmic microwave background radiation.
I guess a lot of these things he'd have to figure out how to do. Well, he wouldn't have to do it. So right now, this is a fringe theory, and it's a fringe theory because it has a really, really strong antecedent, right? That there's really no positive reason to believe. And so there's not a lot of work being done on what would the cosmic microwave background radiation be? How can I make this fit every single thing that actually has been measured in the sky, right? But if they do find there is a negative mass to this anti-hydrogen that you were talking about, then all of a sudden there'll be lots of people working on exactly those sorts of issues.
Well, let's be careful with using the term negative mass, because I think people are going to think that means negative inertial mass, and that's a whole other theory which Robert Forward talked about, and Martin Tymar at the ESA and other institutions in Europe has been looking into. We're just talking about gravitational charge, positive and negative, right? But the thing that I find really compelling, and I can see where a theoretical physicist would be intrigued by this, and I think rightfully, is that with this one idea you can explain, and he shows the calculations to be within error bars on dark matter, dark energy, right? The two biggest cosmological mysteries that we're up against right now. And I think when you've got one idea that can explain both of those, then you've got something which really deserves a close look. Because right now with dark matter, we've ostensibly got 10 times as much dark matter in our galaxy and in countless other galaxies throughout the universe that and we've never detected a single particle to explain what it is. And we're looking really hard. And then dark energy, we seem to be stuck with a completely intractable model of a negative pressure in the quantum vacuum, which I've yet to see a satisfactory explanation for. And plus, this theory abolishes the inflaton, the hypothetical particle that would have driven the Big Bang expansion in the first instant of expansion of the universe. So, that's a pretty impressive set of predictions to make from one hypothesis. And if he's right and the math holds up and the order of magnitude estimates that he has here for the cosmic acceleration and dark matter, then there may be some kind of truth in it.
Well, if he's right, it's hard really to say. I don't know how much traction this really gets. It doesn't look like it's something that's getting a lot of citations. You know, this isn't stuff that he's publishing in Physical Review A or anything like that. So it looks like something that people have a lot of issues with somewhere.
Do you know what those are? That's what I was kind of, I've been kind of hoping to face what those are.
Yeah, I have no idea what those are because I've never heard of this before. You sent this to me and I had a couple of days to read it and just figure out what the guy's doing, let alone try to figure out things about it. And I wouldn't do that much work trying to figure that out either. If he's been talking about it since 2011, it could just be because nobody's heard about it, because he doesn't talk about it to the right people.
Well, I've seen articles on PhysOrg, I saw him interviewed at the Large Hadron Collider, and he was talking with the guys working on the Alpha experiment. It seems like people on the experimental side, at least as far as trying to measure the what happens with anti-hydrogen in a gravitational field, you know, you got three different teams working on that right now, and they seem to know his work and it's sort of, they seem to see it as a kind of lightning rod for their efforts, because that would be the most exciting outcome, right? Is the thing that people expect least. And I've seen objections online on science boards of people denying the idea that antimatter could have a negative gravitational charge. But when you really look at them, and I hope we can do some of that tonight, there really aren't any convincing arguments that against it. I think that it may just be one of these, the momentum of science culture things. I mean, we're so used to thinking that positive inertia equals positive gravitation, period, that because that's what Einstein's theory said. But of course, I don't think Einstein was even aware of, we weren't even aware of antimatter at the time that general relativity was created, right?
No, I wouldn't think so.
And we really didn't have any reason to think about it until...
Well, yeah, definitely not. So antimatter actually was a sort of weird theoretical discovery because it shows up in the Dirac equation. The positron shows up in the Dirac equation just for no particular purpose. So it was a theoretical curiosity, just like this negative gravitational charge would be, right? Because there was no reason to suppose it existed except that it showed up in the first attempt at a relativistic theory of quantum mechanics. And then later on, people found the positron.
Yeah, yeah, that was like 1928 that we got our first indication of the positron, I think.
So that was still, a decade and a half after general relativity was introduced.
Yeah, like 12.
People, I think, are fairly open to the idea that there might be a negative mass for an antiparticle. I just don't think a lot of people give it a lot of weight because there's, again, no positive reason to say it exists. So, I mean, there have been people trying to do these experiments for years, and I don't think anybody's been particularly upset about people trying to do these experiments. I think doing experiments to find out if something like this is actually true are good. I think everybody believes that. We want to test, especially things that we think are most reliable, but we don't have any real evidence for. For example, there is no such thing as a negative gravitational charge. You know, we believe that. You know, there's absolutely no reason to believe that's true other than we've seen absolutely no evidence. So finding some way to test that in any situation at all, really, is a really interesting thing, even if it turns out that the world is as boring as we thought it was.
Right, because we really need to know for sure.
Still won't let us know for sure. It'll just tell us about antiparticles in general. But, you know, that doesn't mean... In the long run, we won't find some other way to make a negative gravitational charge. Right now, the only thing that I think anybody has any hope of seeing a negative gravitational charge in is in antimatter.
Yeah, although I did love the idea that we saw on our last talk with the gravitational dipole generator in Robert Forward's paper, Guidelines to Anti-Gravity paper, where he showed a device that could, at least ostensibly by the linearized equations of general relativity, which hold, that there you could generate a gravitational dipole. So it seems like there's a really strong theoretical basis to believe that it's possible to see that effect one way or the other.
If you can make something as complicated and weird and go fast enough in that particular thing. I guess it's not that weird, but it's just a pretty complicated thing that Bob Forward put in that paper to try to build with some sort of mass current.
Sure, yeah. And it's out. It's certainly going to be outside. That kind of device looks to be far beyond our capabilities in the foreseeable future. But I think it's a proof of principle concept in a theoretical way that, hey, you know, if we could arrange matter to do this in this way, then we would see this effect.
Yeah, but that still wouldn't be a negative gravitational charge. That would be a dipole. That would be literally a dipole. And that would still be a completely different thing.
But that's all that we need for this theory, because that's all he's talking about here, is a virtual gravitational dipole.
That is completely unrelated to this theory. This particular theory, you need something much stronger than what Robert Forward was talking about. In this theory, you need a negative gravitational charge on antimatter. That's a very strong statement. The comparative interest between those two ideas should be very, very large, especially because even though Robert Forward's device looks weird, it's something that we should expect should exist based on the analogy between electricity and gravity.
Right.
On the other hand, the negative gravitational charge opens up something completely new in physics. And that's really exciting. If that's the case, that's really exciting.
Yeah, it seemed like when they brought it up in this BBC production that it would be kind of a watershed moment in that we would suddenly, I guess, have at least some theoretical opportunity to start exploring negative gravitational effects technologically. And, you know, if you think about it, if you had some kind of confinement machine that could suspend antimatter in a vacuum so that it wouldn't touch the matter that contains it. And if you had more of that antimatter inside the device than the regular mass of the device with matter, and this guy's theory is true, the freaking thing should be able to fall up just as naturally as a body of matter falls down, right?
Yeah, that would be a blimp that made the Hindenburg look like a day at the beach, right?
Well, yeah, you wouldn't want to see a failure of that system without annihilating the planet. But, I mean, just conceptually, suddenly we would be going from, here's Robert Forward's idea that you would need an unimaginable technology in order to do in several millennia, and here's something that we could do at a very small scale in a lab that would show us effects that we've never seen before. So that's the kind of thing that we could see happen within our lifetimes, you know?
I mean, we probably would. Or as soon as they figure this out, if they know they can do it, they'll do a lot of engineering and improve their yield on the anti-hydrogen. Well, I'm sure they're working on that now, but they'll get a lot more money to do that then.
Just imagine if we could make anti-iron, right? Then you could just suspend it in a superconductive cylinder, right? So that we could magnetically suspend it. It would be solid, right? It would be almost safe.
I'm sure people are right now thinking about how to create heavier and heavier elements. Heavier and heavier anti-elements, I guess they'd be, right?
Right. Yeah, and we can't even fuse regular matter very well right now, and we're going to try to do it with antimatter.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, you know, as soon as they can get some, that's the next thing. And usually you don't really need to do that with regular matter. There aren't that many things you really want to do that with, except for things that don't last very long to begin with, like, you know, all the unknown unknowniums.
I believe there is an actual unobtainium. Is there something like that? Unobtainium or something? Or
there are a bunch of names like that that are really placeholder names.
Oh, okay.
So these are placeholder names while the chemists get together and argue about what they should name the next few elements that's been discovered. I mean, it used to be the discoverer got to name it, but now they've decided that this is not the right way to do things. You should have an international committee so that, you know, the next element, I think, will be putinium. And there'll be a trumpium pretty soon, I'm sure.
It's going to be the greatest atom ever. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't even really... I'm so excited about the theoretical prospects for this guy's idea that I hadn't even really seriously considered what the technological implications would be. Because it's just such... Cosmologically, we're banging our heads against the dark matter and dark energy and the inflation problem and baryogenesis and all this stuff, that to see one idea that could neatly wrap them all up and tie them off with a bow It's just his work has riveted me for years because there's just nothing else like it. I scour these fringe theoretical papers night and day for years on end, looking for ideas like this that could tie together and resolve some of the biggest mysteries in a really elegant way. And although it's an unpopular idea on the science boards, you know, I'm glad that you've got a broad mind about this kind of thing, because you go onto the chat boards and you get shredded if you mention the idea, any idea like this, that, oh, maybe antimatter has a negative gravitational charge. I mean, people will tear you apart. They don't want to hear it.
Yeah, but why are you on the chat boards?
Well, just a lot of times you'll be like reading an article and then there's a comment section. You know, and so you'll read an interesting article and you'll have something relevant, like, to say about it that might tie in an idea to something else that you think people might find interesting. And, you know, once in a while there's somebody who's like, oh, cool, I'll look into that. But most of the time, and it's usually, you know, the members who have been there for years on end and have, like, a street cred to defend, who will come at you like frickin' Dobermans.
If that's where you want to play, right?
I don't play there too much anymore. I learned my lesson.
That's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, that's one, the internet, and two, you know, the message boards tend to get a little bit worse, especially if they're not really, really, well, I mean, and unless they're really, really moderated. But even in a place like this, it sounds like they're probably even attacking you in ways that wouldn't get them kicked off a moderated board. I don't know. Maybe they are attacking you in ways that would get you kicked off, but you know, they can be pretty vicious.
Yeah.
And still be perfectly within parameters for something like that. I guess we've already talked about this. This idea of his gets rid of, I said five things, but there are four things here, and the fifth is just something that you have to understand to make two of them work. There are four things that I really, really like about the implications of this theory. The first one was that cyclic universe. I like the way that worked out. I have no idea if it's right or not, but it looks very nice, and it gets rid of a singularity. Anytime you get rid of a singularity, I'm with you. The next one was it gets rid of sort of the cosmological constant problem, because the cosmological constant feels to me like phlogiston, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's this soup that's out there that has no particular reason to be there and doesn't even have a real existence. It's just this weird negative pressure, constant density fluid that we don't get to detect, except that somehow it makes the math work.
I want to point out that it would be the one thing in nature, I think, that we've seen so far that doesn't come from or have any direct relation to matter. Like, the matter of the universe is irrelevant in that model. In the current dark energy model, it's just a negative pressure in space-time, and that's it. But yeah, almost everywhere else, we see that, you know, it's a product of the existence of matter interacting with each other through some mechanism.
Yeah, so as far as I can see, that this is able to get rid of it, right? By saying that instead of having this indefinable soup, we have this definable soup of, you know, this quick creation and annihilation of dipoles, because you get that fluctuation. I mean, it may sound like a little thing to some people, but it's actually a meaningful idea about why we have this whole cosmological constant thing rather than the silly soup idea.
And that he was able to get it within the realm of, I can't remember exactly how close his prediction mathematically was to the actual observations we've seen, but they line up pretty damn well.
Yeah, I think that was the one where he said, you know, the number was between 1 and 2, and his back the envelope calculation was 1.5. So experiments said doing 1 or 2 times whatever, and he got 1.5. I think that was that one.
Yeah, but a similar thing came up with the dark matter calculations that he did.
Yes.
He was pretty close there too.
Yeah, he was close in the dark matter and the dark matter and the dark energy were the other two things that I liked him getting rid of those with just this thing again. You have to understand one more weird thing about this theory, which is that there ends up being a gravitational polarization of the vacuum. So, I mean, a polarization is a field. So normally when we think about polarization, we're thinking about a light beam and we're saying, okay, the light beam is polarized and, you know, it's this way or that way. But what he's talking about when he says polarization is a completely different thing. It's like the polarization of a material, Right. It's like the polarization of a dielectric material. And what happens in a dielectric material is that when you put a material inside of a electric field, well, the atoms are made up of a positive part and a negative part.
And they align.
Yeah. Yeah. The positive part wants to go with the field. The negative part wants to go away from it. So you get this sort of net displacement of the nucleus to the electron clouds. And you end up with a dipole. And that dipole at that point is what creates the polarization. So what you say is, okay, if I look at a larger group of these things, I end up with I look at a region that I can say this has a polarization that I can add on to my field in direction, and it creates sort of an extra field bit right there. And then if you add all that up for your entire material, you get your dipole moment for the material. But these little polarization vectors that are all over the material, they're in all sorts of different directions. So they cancel a little bit here, they cancel a little bit there. But if it's in a field, it has a polarization. You can look at this microscopically on the inside of the material, and you see that there are little fluctuations all over the place for what direction the polarization is in. Even though it has a net moment in one direction, it's always different just a little bit. And that's what he's saying happens to space, only with gravity. But it also must happen with electric charge as well, because, the things that are popping into and out of existence that are creating these dipoles are also charged, or mostly charged.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. The fact that the same virtual particles that create the gravitational dipoles in this theory also usually have an electrical charge as well, except for the photons. So those are married together. I wonder if that gives us an opportunity, a theoretical opportunity, to use some kind of electromagnetic technology in order to harness this polarization effect gravitationally.
Yeah, you might be able to force the gravitational polarization using an electric field.
Wow, that's really exciting. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, I was a little bit confused because it wasn't as clear in the PowerPoint that I was looking at today that the gravitational dipoles that he was talking about were the product of the particles themselves, the electrons and positrons and the protons and the antiprotons. When we look at the virtual particles in the vacuum, as I understand it, and let me clear me up if I'm wrong about this, but the heavier particles, something like a proton-antiproton pair, do those exist less frequently in the quantum vacuum, or do they just exist for a smaller interval of time? Because I seem to remember that there was a relationship between their mass and their longevity and their momentum and things like that.
So they'll exist for an amount of time that's inversely proportional to their energy. So heavier ones last for a shorter amount of time. I'm not sure about the actual process, but in most things, when you're creating something, it requires exponentially less probable to create something normally that has a higher energy.
Does that mean that the heavier ones occur less frequently?
I would expect that they would both occur less frequently and that they would disappear more quickly. They would annihilate more quickly. But the first one, I'm not completely sure about. Just the way most things work in physics, they would be produced less often. But I don't have any particular knowledge about that in this particular case, so I could be completely off. But the second part, I'm really sure of. The second part, I'm sure.
It would be fun to, maybe we can do a program sometime about the quantum vacuum, because I'd like to study it more carefully, and maybe we could get some into the nitty gritty of that, because it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah, it is. It is. This is a really interesting reading about it.
Let's see. I guess one of the things I wanted to make sure we went over were the objections. There's some possible evidence against the hypothesis that he's posited here. There was one example that I think probably the most compelling example that I could find was the observations in 1987. When the supernova 1987A exploded something like 167,000 light years away in the Large Magellanic Cloud, I think we observed the photons and three different neutrino detectors on the Earth detected the arrival of neutrinos simultaneously. And this is cited as evidence that the neutrinos must have followed the same gravitational path as the photons to arrive at the same time. But it also seems that our detectors can't distinguish between the interaction of antineutrinos and neutrinos, at least not very well. So they don't know if they were neutrinos or antineutrinos or both. Now, in Hajdukovic's theory, I imagine that neutrinos would be mass particles, and so they'd follow the normal gravitational curve just like photons would. And antineutrinos, I guess, would be repelled by gravitational fields, so they'd take a different path. But if the antineutrinos took a different path, then maybe all we detected was the neutrinos. And they said there was an estimate of like 1 to 10% chance that we only detected neutrinos and no antineutrinos. I'm not sure how they do that math, you know, especially in light of the idea that if the antineutrinos took a different path, then maybe they would have been detected later, or maybe that signal could have been lost against the cosmic background. I'm not really sure. But that was the strongest experimental case that I could find, and it seems like there's still a lot of questions about it. One of the questions is the neutrino itself. That seems to be kind of a mysterious particle. It seems like we haven't quite figured out yet if those are Dirac fermions or Majorana fermions. And if they're Majorana fermions, then their chirality is the only thing that's different between the matter and antimatter version, I guess in a similar way that photons are their own antiparticle.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, they have antineutrinos. I think there's a lot that they don't know about neutrinos. They do talk about these oscillations with neutrinos between the different levels of neutrino or whatever they are. But, I mean, if they were arriving at the same time with 1987A, at least some proportion of them in whatever distance that was. I'm not sure how far away was 1987A.
It was 167,000 light years. It was in the Large Magellanic Cloud.
Okay, then if these were showing up at that time, given that the neutrino detectors are really inefficient, then you'd say that a lot of them were not doing those oscillations, because as soon as they do an oscillation that makes them massive, they have to slow down to less than the speed of light. And so we would not see them at the same time.
Okay, that's right. They'd be seriously delayed if they slowed down at all, because that's a huge interval.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that it seems like every time we've measured the neutrino velocities, that it's always been c.
Yes.
Like, I don't think I've seen a measurement yet where they didn't travel at c. And that just raises the whole question, how can they travel at the constant c, just like light, and still have a rest mass?
So right now they think that at least one of those neutrino bits in the neutrino oscillations has the mass.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that all of them do.
Oh, weird.
The other two could still have no rest mass. That could include your electron neutrino, right?
Oh.
Which would be your most common one.
Oh. So I guess in our lab experiments we're not able to make the massive kinds, huh? Or they don't have time to oscillate, maybe, between the emitter and the detector.
Yeah, you've got all sorts of issues. They wouldn't have time to oscillate on a terrestrial experiment, I don't think. I'm not sure how well they create them, but I don't think they'd have time to oscillate on top of being difficult to detect and all those other things. So they don't get that mass from terrestrial experiments. They get them from neutrino oscillations.
Like the sun? Right, because I think there was the missing neutrino problem back in the day. And they figured that out because there was enough time for them to oscillate between the sun and the Earth, that if like a third of them became a different kind that we weren't detecting. Is that right?
I don't really know enough about it.
Well, so that seems like there's so many questions about neutrinos and antineutrinos and oscillations and all that kind of business. It seems like that's pretty weak experimental evidence to refute the idea that antimatter would have a negative gravitational a charge, right? And so the only other thing, that the other argument that I've seen is the theoretical one, which we've kind of talked about already, which is you know, the general principle, the general theory of general relativity, and the weak equivalence principle, where we assume that positive inertia equals a positive gravitational charge. But again, we can't be sure. right? I mean, until we have some kind of experimental evidence, we can't say that because the theory says it, that it must be true, because theories evolve.
Yeah, that's not really a good argument at all.
Are there any good arguments that you can think of that are like, well, this could be a showstopper?
Well, if you'd like to, there is a review article that he mentions here, as well as the original article from Physics Reports, The Arguments Against Anti-Gravity and the Gravitational Acceleration of Antimatter by Nieto and Goldman. Maybe it's Nieto, but it's N-I-E-T-O. And the arguments that he gives against anti-gravity are trying to show that anti-gravity is somehow incompatible with the conservation of energy. And this is a technical argument. Another one is that different materials should contain different fractions of the virtual antimatter. So if it falls up, it should already have been detected by classical tests of the weak equivalence principle. That one's by Schiff, who is a guy who's big in GR. And then there was one that was based on CP violation that would say that there would be a very large charge parity violation, but CP violation is now known to exist, so that's probably archaic.
Okay, I'll have to look at these. I'm intrigued by Schiff's argument because I've never heard that before, that this phenomenon would lead to a violation of the weak equivalence principle in laboratory experiments. But do you understand that Schiff argument?
Not at all.
That's all right. I'll look into it. I like having more reading to do because then you know where to look, you know, in order to see the disproofs in the lab. Okay. Well,
okay. One last thing that he says is an argument for it, which is by Velotta, right? Which was what? That general relativity taken together with the CPT theorem, that charge parity and time are conserved, lead to the prediction that there's going to be a gravitational repulsion between matter and antimatter.
Right. So then you've got the other hand of the argument where he's saying that it would predict this effect. I guess that makes sense because if you reverse time, then anything that appears to be gravitationally attractive would appear to be gravitationally repulsive in a inverse time. I like Velotta. He's got a number of articles online, but I think it was his idea that he thinks that that there's an equal amount of antimatter in the universe, but he's the one who thinks that it exists in these large intergalactic voids.
I actually like the discussion here about some of these gravitational charges or the gravitational charge density and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know anything about antimatter in the cosmic voids. I don't know what it would look like. I kind of suspect that if it was there's enough going on, enough random things going on, that you would see traces of it.
Yeah, you'd see those annihilation signals coming out of those voids, right? As a piece of rock or something flew in there and blew apart.
Yeah, that's what I think, but what do I know?
Yeah. I guess we won't know until we see it.
I mean, I have no idea how often giant pieces of galaxies decide to fly off into the voids of things, but...
You think it would happen, yeah. Right? Because stuff's blowing up all the time. You got supernovas and things.
Yeah, I'd expect it, but I have no idea what really happens in those events.
I think I remember the name of that satellite. I think it was the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer 2 that's in orbit right now, and one of its missions is to look for antimatter. And the brilliant Nobel laureate who designed the thing said that if we can detect just one atom of anti-helium, then we've got proof that there's antimatter stars out there. And so when we've got some indication that there may be entire galaxies made out of antimatter. And, you know, I guess you could make an argument for that, because if antimatter and matter are gravitationally repulsive, then maybe an antimatter galaxy would push away all of the incoming matter so that it wouldn't actually penetrate it. Maybe after enough time, anyway.
If you do have large regions of antimatter in between the galaxies, that would definitely. And if the antimatter has and if the antimatter repels matter, then that would keep everything inside of the silly galaxy things, and keep the antimatter from getting into the galaxies. So you wouldn't get too many interesting events. But then you probably should get some fairly large concentrations of that antimatter as well.
That's right, but unless it interacts with something, you wouldn't be able to detect it from looking at it, as I understand it.
Oh, well, yeah, but you might end up back with antimatter galaxies.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe there wouldn't be enough of a gravitational thing to do that, but you'd think that if you have big things pushing you away from them towards things that you want to be attracted to, pretty soon you'd end up with big agglomerations of stuff, and then now you'd have all of these things that we could actually detect.
Yeah, and we can see back how many billions of light years into the universe, and we were not seeing these gamma events, you know, just these annihilation events anywhere. Well, I really love Hajdukovic's work, and I'm glad that you found it interesting.
It was fun reading this, and it's something that I think I can accost people with on the street.
Well, be careful. Don't accost any science board people on the street, because they'll have your head.
Science board people are a lot more polite in person than they are on the science board.
Oh, yeah, I forget about that. Everybody's a big dog when they're using an anonymous avatar. All right, Jim, thanks for going over this with you today, and it's good to learn some things about these arguments and look at them from a fresh perspective, and I'm glad we got to share that with our audience.
I bet they're as excited as we are.
Well, somebody out there is. I can feel it.
I know all 10 of them, and I know that they're excited. Let's wrap this up and get to the beer, all right?
Sounds good. I think I'm going to get myself one right now.
All right.
Thank you, Jim.